Today on New Horizons, Ann Patchett, author of the novel Run, the first year read at Boise State.
I do a lot of magazine work, I do a lot of essays, and I know what it means to write for an audience. I write my novels entirely for myself. I write the book I want to read. I'm so interested in that relationship between students and teachers. With a sentence, with a thought, with a comment, with a single lecture, an assignment, changes the course of your life. The book that I type the last page of is going to be very close to what you hold in your hands when it's published, because I've really edited as I go along.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. In her novel Run, Ann Patchett shows us how privilege and poverty can coexist only blocks apart from one another, and how family can include people you've never even met. Praised by the Washington Post as engaging, surprising, provocative, and moving, Run is the 2009-2010 first-year read at Boise State. All incoming first-year students received the book during their orientation this summer, and were expected to read it in preparation for the fall semester. Run is the first novel selected during the 4 years the program has been in existence at Boise State. Ann Patchett's books consistently have earned high marks from critics. Bel Canto, published in 2001, received the Orange Prize for Fiction and the Penn Faulkner Award and has been translated into 30 languages and was the Boise Read a few years ago. Truth and Beauty, a memoir of Ms. Patchett's friendship with the writer Lucy Greeley, was named one of the best books of the year by the Chicago Tribune, the San Francisco Chronicle, and Entertainment Weekly, and earned a number of additional awards. Ann Patchett visited Boise State earlier this week as a guest of the university's first-year read program. She joined me in the studio for today's interview. Ann Patchett, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to start off with a question that tries to avoid the plot of your book. I'm that old professor who doesn't want to give away the ending or even the middle, or in your case, in this book, even some things that happen fairly quickly into the book, so as to discourage our listeners and especially our students from finishing it. So we're going to try to work this interview around the specific plot of the book, but talk generally about it. But the first thing I want to talk to you about is your job as an author. Lately, there's been this big thing about book wars. Amazon and Walmart are at each other's throats, lowering the price. The last I heard, the bestseller was down to $8.98. And every time I hear that report, no matter where it's coming from, I hear concern about publishers. I hear concern about bookstores. I hear concern about independent bookstores. I hear concern about everybody but authors. And I'm thinking, especially when you're young, you're a budding author, you're seeking out a publisher, you're trying to make a living, you're trying to raise a family, at what point does the book war impact the ability of authors to ply their trade?
It absolutely doesn't, because that book war situation affects Dan Brown. That's who's worrying about his $8.98 book. The rest of us, it just doesn't even figure into it. You have to be such a mega, mega bestseller in order to be at that kind of a price point. And at that point, yes, it might affect your royalties, but then you're operating in such an enormous volume that you're still getting a huge amount of money. So I think that the authors are fine, and I think that the book wars will go the way of the cola wars. It's just the fad of the moment. And again, that's how much it's selling for at Walmart, at Amazon. That's not where America is buying every single book they're getting their hands on.
Yeah. The other thing I mentioned to you before the show that I was at Barnes & Noble the other day, and there's a really interesting transformation taking place at Barnes & Noble and Borders both. The numbers of bookshelves are declining, and the numbers of games and puzzles and toy shelves are increasing dramatically. So it has to affect at least the selection of books. Have you noticed that?
Well, yes. And for me, what I always notice, wind chimes, soap, hand lotion, coffee cups. I'm always saying, you know, I want to shop in a bookstore. I don't want to shop in a novelty store.
Right.
But the amount of profit on those items is so much higher than it is on books. So, yes, people come in for that $8.98 Dan right. Brown novel, but they're also going to get Monopoly or some wind chimes. Mm-hmm. And then the bookstore is, they're finding a way to survive. They're mm-hmm. retooling. Mm-hmm. Smart.
Now, when I think of you as an author, I think of you finishing a book, getting it published, and then off you go on this tour. And I walk into a Barnes & Noble or an independent bookstore someday, and there's Ann Patchett sitting there signing books, talking to people, getting reactions from people about previous novels you've written. And along comes Kindle. All of a sudden, there's a percentage of readers who are your fans that you can't really touch the way you could the person waiting to get your autograph for a book. Do you think that's going to change? Does that make any difference in your life as an author when it comes to the way your books are selling, quote unquote? I mean, the relationship the author has with the reader.
I don't think it does affect that, because really, even if somebody wants to buy my book on a Kindle, but they want to see me, and there is a very tiresome cult of personality and celebrity in this country, which has trickled down to the authors, and there are people who think you're a really small rock star, and they're going to come out and hear you read and shake your hand and get you to autograph a blank piece of paper if they don't mm-hmm. have a book. I actually was at a reading recently where somebody brought their Kindle and had the author autograph their Kindle with a Sharpie.
Well, there you go. That solves my problem then. I'll bring my Kindle along next time.
But I think what you've got to remember about Kindle and electronic publishing is it represents the fastest growing division in publishing, but it still only represents 2-3% of book sales. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of what everybody's talking about, but really people are still wanting books. Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated to see in your bio that you, of course, you're a graduate of Sarah Lawrence, and then you went on to the Iowa Writers Creative Workshop, which is clearly the best in the country, everyone tells me. But Russell Banks was one of your faculty members. Russell Banks, over the years, has become my favorite author. I wait for his books to come out. When he was in Chicago many years ago introducing one of his new books at a bookstore then called Crocs and Brentano's, that you may remember.
I remember it very well.
I called him up. I was serving as lieutenant governor, and he didn't know what was going on in his life, but I called him up and asked if I could introduce him at Crocs and Brentano's, and went over and gave the introduction to Russell Banks. I mean, he must have thought I was absolutely crazy. Who's this nutcase from politics coming out to introduce me? So I have to ask you what it's like as a student working alongside a major American novelist, and how do you learn from a guy like that?
Well, I'll tell you, Russell was not a major American novelist when I was working.
Oh, okay. All right.
It was a long time ago. That was when I was in college. And he certainly had several books out. Russell is a great guy, and I see him every now and then over the years. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. It's interesting that he is your favorite writer, because I find his books so heartbreaking. I can almost not bear them. Mm-hmm. He's a brilliant writer, a beautiful writer, a great deep thinker, but his books destroy me, mm-hmm. and I read them all. But Russell Banks was a very, very important person in my life for this reason. When I was a senior in college, he was the last creative writing class I took at Sarah Lawrence, and he called me into his office one day, and he said, "You're the best student I've got. You're a really, really talented writer. And because you're really talented and you're better than the other students, you can skate by and do very little work. And everybody is going to think that the little work that you do is fantastic." And he said, "You have to ask yourself if you want to write great fiction or great television." I will never forget that in my life. And he said, "You have the capacity to go much deeper, to work harder, and to do much better. But nobody can make you do that but you. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a television writer and you can be clever and facile, you'll shoot the lights out, you'll make a fortune, you'll have a great life. But if you want to be smarter and do better, you have to do that for yourself." And that was a life-changing moment for me. And I have had this conversation with Russell over the years, and he always says, "I have no memory saying it to you." But I'm so interested in that relationship between students and teachers, and how you can have a teacher who completely shapes your life with a sentence, with a thought, with a comment, with a single lecture, an assignment, changes the course of your life, and they don't remember you.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like another book.
That is. That's actually exactly what I'm working on right now.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, great.
That relationship between an adult, student, and teacher mm-hmm. where the teacher just shaped the student's life and they meet again and the teacher does not remember the student.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, did you also have these kinds of experiences and relationships with faculty where they came away making Ann Patchett who she is today?
You know, I didn't. And mm-hmm. it was an odd thing. At Sarah Lawrence, I studied a year with Grace Paley, who was phenomenal, a year yeah. with Alan Gerganis, who was the greatest teacher I ever had, and a year with Russell Banks. And they were all tenured faculty at Sarah Lawrence. We had classes of 12 students. You met with them individually every week. Wow. They did everything but cut your meat for you at the cafeteria. I went to the University of Iowa, where people came in for a semester. They were superstars. They really weren't interested in making that kind of a bonding commitment sure. to their students. So I saw a lot of people who were great come and go, but I never got anything out of it that touched my experience as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm.
One of the reviews of your works, I think it might have been the book Run, said something to the effect that you prefer nouns and verbs to adjectives and adverbs. And I think that the New York Times review put it like this, that you're hammers and nails instead of glue and lace. And I thought that was so fascinating. And I mean, I'm going to have you explain that for one thing, because I'm not so sure I understand it. But I must admit that I do pick up, again, for those of us that are frustrated writers, and I'm in that category, and I doubt the time will ever come that I have a chance to do anything near the kind of writing you ever have done. But for those who are frustrated writers, there are some things you pick up where the adjectives and adverbs are so overbearing and overwhelming that you walk away thinking, I could never do it. But it seems like what I get out of this reviewer is that you're a storyteller.
Yes.
And those of us who doubt ourselves probably have a greater chance of being a storyteller than being great with the adjectives and adverbs. Help me with that.
Well, I think that assessment is very true, and it's something that I like. I am a very straightforward writer, and I do like to tell stories. I'm not a beautiful writer. I don't really ever want a reader to stop at a sentence and say, oh, that sentence just took my breath away. I want them to be immersed in the story, and I want them to move on that current. I think that what happens is there are people who are fantastic writers, beautiful, beautiful writers, make gorgeous characters, but they don't necessarily know how to tell a story. So you read the book, and ultimately the book is unsatisfying. Then you have another category of writers who are great storytellers, but they're really somewhere between mediocre and lousy writers. And they usually write commercial fiction, or kind of a cheaper brand of commercial fiction, the kind that might be mm-hmm. selling for $8.98 at
right,
Walgreens.
Right.
And I think that those are people who really know how to tell a story, but not beautifully. And rare is the person who can do both, who can do something with beauty and artistry, but also really know how to bring a story home. I've read so many books in which I feel like someone is juggling 20 balls, and I am just mesmerized by what they're pulling off. And at the end, it's as if they just put their hands down and all the balls fall to the floor. Mm-hmm. And I really want to see a book in which things are brought home, where it amounts to something.
Bringing the story home, that's another issue with me that I think is fascinating. There's an author here in Idaho who is long gone, but his name's Vardis Fisher. And I think I remember in the old, old reviews of Vardis that people criticized the fact that he was preaching to people all the time. Now, your book has a significant lesson in it for all of us. You are definitely telling a story that has meaning. And as you say, brings the story home. It's not just the story, it's what we're going to learn from the story. I guess the question is, how does an author know where to draw the line between the preaching, and do you rewrite a lot? And when you read it the first couple of times and think, oh boy, there I go again. I've given way too much away. I must be way more subtle in the way I present this story if I'm not going to look like somebody who has just written nonfiction instead of fiction, perhaps?
I can answer that very easily. And the difference between preaching and having a book with a message is, are you going to put out the question or are you going to put out the answer? And when you're preaching, you're putting out the answer. I hope I am putting out the questions. I am saying, these are the things They keep me up at night. These are the things that I care about. These are the things that I couldn't not write about. The intersection of wealth and poverty, race, class in America, the construction of family. Those are the things that I don't want to write about. And I finish a book and I read the book and I think, oh, look, there they are again, because those are the issues of my heart. But I don't give any answers. I don't say, well, this is how you must do it in your life. This is the right way to do it. I say my characters are struggling with these questions.
And here's how they figured it out.
And I hope as a reader, people will sit down and struggle too. One of the great lessons I learned from Bel Canto, having a big bestseller, was the power of book clubs and that people were getting together and discussing issues. So yes, I do want to put issues forward because I know that people are going to be sitting in their living room and they're going to be talking about race and class and wealth and poverty. Mm-hmm. That's great.
You're listening to Ann Patchett. She is the author of Run. She is on the Boise State campus for our first year read. Let's talk a moment about reviewers. How do you react to reviewers? Do you pay any attention to them? Do you bother to read what they have to say about your work? And most importantly, does it ever impact how you look at something you're going to do down the road?
Well, a good review makes me happy for 15 minutes, and a bad review hurts my feelings for 15 minutes. And that's absolutely how important it is. I don't always read them all because I'll tell you they are boring. Because 90% of any review is a plot synopsis. And to sit down and read a plot synopsis, and the plot synopsis is never right, again and again and again, it drives me crazy. And often, the really good review makes me feel worse than the bad review because they're loving it, but they got the book so wrong. You know, they give you a plot synopsis that makes you know absolutely they didn't read the book, but then they loved it. So you can't really feel good about that. Does it influence me going into the future? No, it doesn't. You know, I do a lot of magazine work. I do a lot of essays, and I know what it means to write for an audience. I write my novels entirely for myself. I write the book I want to read. The book I can't find is the book that I want to write. So nothing impacts that except my own enjoyment.
When you open up a paperback after it's been out in hardcover, oftentimes you find other authors commenting on their colleagues' work.
Right.
And I notice it particularly in thrillers, where you have some of these folks. There's a guy in Wyoming named C.J. Box who has written a slew of novels about the Wyoming landscape, and it's basically thriller-type stuff. And it looks to me like the publisher has managed to find all the other colleagues who probably publish for the same company. I mean, is that pretty much insider baseball when it comes to the way that works?
It's not the same company at all, but every single day of my life, UPS or FedEx arrives with a book. And they're galleys. They're books that have yet to be published because somebody wants me to read it and give a blurb. The question is, who can guilt me into actually opening up the book? There is no way in the world I could read these books. I mean, I feel like if I get it out of the envelope, if I get it recycled, if I write a note to the editor saying, I'm sorry, I couldn't do this, I'm right. really doing a good job. but it's the people who, they have some weird connection to me, either their editor, their agent, or the author themselves, or they have a friend who knows me and can send me a note and say, please, as a favor, just at least pick this up. It is a real burden and a waste of time because I spend half of my life reading the first 20 pages of books that I never finish.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly understandable that you wouldn't have time to read books that are simply in draft form. But what about the books that are out there that have really worked? That now, and I'm not talking about the bestseller list necessarily. I'm talking about fine works of fiction. First of all, is there time while you're working on a life of always worrying about a next book? And if there is time, who do you just enjoy reading?
I've been on a big Henry James tear for the last 4 or 5 years. It happens in sort of levels. There are the galleys that I read. There are the contemporary fiction that I read because my friends have written it. My friends are all writers. You know, a lot of my reading is just keeping up with that. Or there's kind of the book of the moment that I want to read just to stay current. I just read a brilliant book by Colm McCann called Let the Great World Spin, one of the best books I've read in years. That was a case of several people calling me up and saying, oh, you have to read this book, so I drop everything, I read that book. If I'm going to be reading just for myself, then I'm going to go back and I'm going to read the classics. In fact, right now I'm reading a 900-page Anthony Trollope novel called The Way We Live Now.
Now, that's something if you've got time for an Anthony Trollope novel.
It's my first. I'm really excited about it.
That's cool.
I spend a lot of my life on airplanes, so I can
That'll
get this Trollope.
Yeah, that's how to handle an Anthony Trollope novel for sure. When you're, as I think I read that you have an editor that works with you closely. I got the impression it was more of a friend.
I have a friend, yes, not an editor, but a friend who's a writer who edits my work.
Right. So you do the first draft. Is that when you hand it over, or do you go through it numerous times before yourself? And how does the editing process work? How long does it take?
Well, I work in a very particular way. It's not the right way. It's just the way I work, which is I edit as I go along. And I usually send my work to Elizabeth in 100-page increments. Elizabeth McCracken is another novelist. But I keep going back, going back, going back. And it gets better and better as I go along. When I finish a book, it's pretty much done. The book that I type the last page of is going to be very close to what you hold in your hands when it's published, because I've really edited as I go along. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, on the other hand, is somebody who finishes a draft of a book and then she says, you know, I think I want to merge these two characters, or I really want this to take place 50 years before it takes place. I could no more imagine doing that than I could building a house and then saying, you know what, I want a basement. I'm going to go into this completed house and dig out a basement. Right. I have to do the basement first and then build up in order.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to the role of publishing the book, is it that difficult for someone to take a book and get it to market when it comes to identifying who's going to be interested in this thing? And I'm thinking of our young writers that are coming out of our own Masters of Fine Arts program in creative writing. What's it like? I mean, for you, obviously, it's easy. You have a publisher, and they have great faith in you, and they know you're a best-selling author. But what about this author that's just starting up?
Really, it's as simple as whether or not the book is good. Mm-hmm. There is still a commercial marketplace for fiction and for nonfiction. People want to buy good books. They want to make a profit off of them. Mm-hmm. If a book is great, it will absolutely find its way. Mm-hmm. If a book is good, it may find its way. It may not find its way. I mean, there's definitely a variable, and a lot of bad stuff gets published. But somebody who has a finished manuscript that is very good, they will get it published. They will get an agent, and that is the key. Gone are the days when you send your book into the slush pile at Knopf and Random House and wait to hear back. The slush pile now exists at the level of the agents, and houses will only look at agented manuscripts. So that's your first step.
And the agent relationship is one where you're just signing a contract with somebody where they're going to take a percentage of what you get, or do you have to put money up front for those kinds of things?
Oh, no. They get a percentage. Mm-hmm. I've been with the same agent since I was 25 years old, and she definitely owns 15% of my life. I think she owns 15% of my tubes of toothpaste. Mm-hmm. But she's a very good friend. She looks after me. They have a huge legal staff. And that's what the money really goes for, the lawyers and the contracts and the foreign rights and the movie rights and getting everything taken care of.
Mm-hmm. So, Run, again, we're not going to talk about the plot, but we are going to talk about the themes. And let's just talk about the theme of responsibility for a moment. After I read your book, I thought, boy, I bet Ann Patchett is in favor of health care reform as it's winding its way through Congress right now. And again,
is she ever?
No, see, I'm right already.
Yeah.
Because I could just tell that your book is about people taking care of other people, whether they want to call it family or whether you want to call it something else. It's about people taking care of other people.
We have a responsibility to our community, to our country, and to our mammal selves, you know, to our species. I think humans have responsibility to one another. And I also, I'm married to a doctor who's very, very much in favor of universal coverage. And so this is a great topic of conversation around our house. But yes, both practically, because I think people will get better care for a lower cost, but also morally, it isn't enough to look out for yourself. Because the people who can't look out for themselves wind up in the emergency room with progressive illnesses that wind up being a lot more expensive.
That doctor apparently thought much of this responsibility concept a few years ago when he thought maybe he'd make you the First Lady of Tennessee.
Oh, yes, yes. My husband did really think about running for governor. He's from Mississippi, and he is an incredibly smart, social, giftedly social person who has high political ideas. And I'm very, very grateful that he didn't do that.
The book, the theme of a father's call to his sons to take up the mantle of responsibility for others. When you started the book, is it like, I know right where I'm going and I know where this is going to wind up? Or are you one of those authors who gets into it and sees where it's going just by the way things look on any given morning you're writing?
No, for the most part, I am definitely, I start it and I know where I'm going and I know how it's going to end. Now, I do not have an idea and start a book that day.
You don't outline it.
I think about it for a year or two before I start. I do outline it and I do it all in my head. Because I do it over such a long period of time. I change my mind about things all the time. Originally, this was going to be a book about science and saving the world through science or possibly through religion. I came to politics very late in the game. It was going to be set in New Jersey. Then I moved it to Boston. You know, things change, but I don't write it and then think, well, no, I think I'll move that around. You know, I really do that work up front.
Do you have to go to these places when you made the decision to move it from Paterson, New Jersey, over to Boston, and then it became Boston? So is that where you grew up, by the way? Or
no, I grew up in Nashville.
Okay. Oh, you grew up. Yeah. So Boston. Do you need to get a flavor of what Boston's all about? Nashville.
I had spent time in Boston, and I have a lot of
friends. Well, that's where you went to school.
Right.
Yeah.
No, actually, I didn't go to school in Boston, but I had a fellowship. I was at Radcliffe for a year postgraduate.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I've been in and out of Boston a lot. On the other hand, I'm writing a book right now that's set in the Amazon in Brazil. So I don't really know much of anything about the Amazon. I did go down there. I will go down there again, probably when the book is finished, just to fact check some things. But, you know, what's important in the book to me are the relationships between the people. And you get the people right. The setting, you definitely don't want it to be wrong, but you don't have to go live someplace for years and years to get the setting right. Mm.
I grew up in St. Louis in a very racially conflicted era when there was segregation across the city. And so your book really struck some responsive chords about some very difficult years of my life when blacks and whites were struggling to figure out a way to live together. And one of the things that I found interesting about your book is the way you managed to place a tenement project, a housing project, so close to wealth and privilege.
And that was an amazing story because when I moved it to Boston, I thought it was going to be Boston and Roxbury, and the characters would be about 3 or 4 miles apart. And I was looking for a house for my Doyle family, and I was out with some Boston friends. We were driving around, found the perfect neighborhood, exactly the house in the street I wanted them on, and then we drove around the corner, and there was a project 2 blocks away. And I just thought, bingo, you know, this is absolutely it. It doesn't have to be 3 miles away. Mm-hmm. That wealth and poverty all across this country really are right next door to one another.
Well, with that, we're going to allow our listeners to get back to your book and finish it.
I appreciate
that. And I can't tell you how lucky we are to have you here on this campus. And our students are very fortunate to be able to read your book. But thank you for joining us here on New Horizons.
Thank you. I've had a wonderful time.
Ann Patchett, the author of Run. Next week, Doug Biesecker of the National Space Weather Prediction Center talking about weather in space and its impacts on Earth. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.